You're listening to the Wisconsin Public Radio Route 51 Hear Me Out debate between the two Democrats who will be on the ballot in the 7th Congressional District, Margaret Engebretson and Brian Ewert, who are both with us today in our Wisconsin Public Radio studio in Wausau. I'm Glenn Moberg, the host of Route 51, our regional talk show based in Wausau, with Daniel Kading, the host of Hear Me Out, our regional talk show based in Superior. Margaret Engebretson of Balsam Lake is a 24-year retired veteran of the U.S. military who has worked as a union electrician, a deputy sheriff of corrections, and is a practicing attorney. Brian Ewert of Marshfield has worked for 25 years as a physician. He is a former president and CEO of the Marshfield Clinic. The two candidates square off in the August 14th primary election. The winner will take on incumbent Republican Congressman Sean Duffy in November to represent the 7th District, which covers much of north central and northwestern Wisconsin. Each candidate will have 1 minute to answer the questions posed by Danny Kading and me, followed by a short open discussion period. Those of you listening on the radio can be a part of this debate. If you have a question for Brian Ewert or Margaret Engebretson, give us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or you can post your question online at wpr.org/route51. Brian Ewert and Margaret Engebretson, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And we are going to go right to the calls with Sally in Medford. Sally, you have our opening question for our two candidates.
Thank you. As a member of Congress, your duty in Washington will be to represent the interests of the people of the 7th District. I would like to know how you will use your leadership role here at home to motivate your constituents to embrace their own duties of citizenship in a time when distrust of public institutions is high, community participation is low, and civic engagement trends toward the ugly and unpleasant.
All right, Sally, thanks so much for that question. Let's go first to Margaret Engebretson. Margaret, you've got about 60 seconds.
Well, good morning, Sally. I hope Medford is nice today. I really appreciate that question that you asked. It's something that I've put a lot of thought into, especially since the 2016 elections, and it is in large part why I decided to run for Congress. So right after the elections, I wasn't working at the time because I was still recovering from surgery, but I took the time to really examine what is ailing our country. And one of the things I discovered is that people are feeling disengaged and there's a lot of hopelessness out there. And I just evaluated what skills and abilities that I personally possess and felt that it was time to step forward and put those in service of my nation right now. So I think a combination of leading by example and encouraging citizens to engage, I think is a really great way to start to turn this country around. Something that I say often is, you know, whatever time you have or abilities you have, just pick a role and jump in, and we must unite.
Brian Ewert, you have 60 seconds.
Thank you, Sally. It's a core issue in terms of how we maintain our democracy and keep it strong. I think the reasons that I got into this race, because I have a lifetime of service, and that service is in healthcare, where we focus on the mission of taking care of patients, whether at the bedside or in leadership, making sure that we continue to have the resources and people available. So that's why I got into this race. I think what you touch on is that there are voices of hate and fear and anger, and we need to be a different voice. We need to speak of how we unify our neighborhoods, how we strengthen our communities, because at the end of the day, we live in communities, not political parties. So in terms of the role I see is that in my physician role as a doctor and in leadership, I've always worked to making sure I focus on the mission, whether that be care for the patients at the bedside or making sure the services are available. And I see that continuing in serving all the people in northern Wisconsin in Congress of paying attention to their interests and making sure that they are being well represented.
Thank you, Brian Ewert. Let me bring in my colleague Danny Kading, who is in our Wisconsin Public Radio studio in Superior, for the first question for our candidates. Danny?
Thank you so much, Glenn. I appreciate that. Congressman Duffy has been an outstanding outspoken supporter of President Trump since the 2016 election, which the president won with the help of voters in the 7th District. On July 23rd, Duffy called Trump the strongest jobs president in decades. What do you think of the president and his record? First, Brian, and then Margaret.
Brian?
Yes, thank you, Danny. Well, I think, first of all, we need to realize that this economic expansion started with Congressman Obie helping pass the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, and since then, the economy has been expanding. So the credit belongs with Congressman Obie, and I am grateful for his endorsement. I think the other part is we recognize that even though the economy has expanded, the people in northern Wisconsin are being left behind. And that's why we need a representative in Congress who will be a balance of power with the presidency, particularly with the tariffs. 107 Republican representatives sent a letter to President Trump challenging the tariffs. Congressman Duffy chose not to represent the farmers and workers of northern Wisconsin in being the balance of power. I would be there in Congress to make sure that the interests of the hardworking farmers and workers who have developed international markets are preserved and represented.
And let's move to Margaret Ingebretson. Margaret?
Yeah, I would disagree with the notion that President Trump is the strongest jobs president. You know, our unemployment rate is low, that is correct, but if you dig just beneath the surface, the quality of a lot of the jobs, especially in the 7th Congressional District, are such that they don't provide a living wage. One of the things we need to move toward is raising the federal minimum wage, but we also need to focus on small businesses so that they can not only survive but thrive. I know folks out there that have more than one job. They're barely making it. And one of the big contributing factors to unease and fear with a lot of the people of the 7th is the lack of reliable health care. And that's one of the reasons that I'm advocating that we move toward a single-payer Medicare for All public health insurance program that covers everyone regardless of their employment circumstance. And these tariffs that President Trump has done have been a sledgehammer. What we need to do is use a scalpel. These are harming Wisconsin farmers and manufacturers.
And Danny Kading, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, I guess I'm just wondering how you think the president will impact midterm elections, specifically the 7th District race.
Brian, why don't we start, and this is an open discussion period.
You know, I think, first of all, recognizing that President Trump obviously was effective at addressing people's pain when he campaigned, I think he has found it to be challenging to address solutions. And clearly, we need to work on creating solutions and solving the problems here in northern Wisconsin. And what we have seen is the policies enacted since 2016 have not helped the people here in northern Wisconsin. We do have wage stagnation. We have loss of the middle class, and that's what we need to be addressing.
Margaret?
Yes, President Trump will have an impact on every single race across this great nation of ours, and that includes the 7th Congressional District. You know, Representative Sean Duffy has aligned himself very closely with President Trump, so I really think it will have an impact. And the message out there is one of divisiveness and fear-mongering, and I hope that the people of the 7th Congressional District just, you know, turn their back on that and turn towards each other, because we must come together. We must turn out at the polls to make our voices heard as citizens. We can turn this thing around. We must turn this thing around.
Very quickly, either of you think he should be impeached? Some Democrats say that we should go through impeachment proceedings if Democrats take control of the House.
You know, at this point, I'm not aware of any evidence that has come forward and been confirmed. So I think, as opposed to focusing on impeaching President Trump, we need to focus on using our time in Washington to solve people's problems, because we have 8 years of inaction by the current Congress. We have a lot of work to do, and I would rather move forward with strengthening the 7th Congressional District.
Margaret, would you work for impeachment?
It's the constitutional duty of Congress to provide a check and balance on the executive branch by providing oversight. The Republican majority has abdicated this duty and refused to place any meaningful constraints on the president. We must first undertake less extreme measures like providing meaningful oversight, hold hearings, or write legislation designed to enforce vital democratic norms we have left unwritten. Though impeachment of the president may be justified at some point, it is an extreme measure that would severely strain our already fractured body politic. We must do what's best for our nation's long-term health and safety. The question is, when is the trauma of impeachment less than the danger posed by the president to our republic?
The health insurance industry is a big employer here. What's your position on the Affordable Care Act? Do you support it? Do you want to modify it? Do you want to replace it with a single-payer system? Or should it be scrapped entirely and left up to the free market? Is health care a right, a privilege, or a responsibility? Margaret Engebretson, let's start with you.
Yes, we are enduring a long-term health care crisis in this country. I mentioned earlier that this is really harming the people of the 7th Congressional District who are already barely getting by. Look, the Affordable Care Act was a really great step in the right direction. But after studying this and talking to a lot of healthcare professionals, we must set the long-term goal of a single-payer Medicare for All public health insurance program so that never again does anyone have to worry about their health insurance. And it stays with you from the day you're born to the day you die. And as far as right, privilege, responsibility, I just think that it's the right thing to do. It's the American thing to do. And in the long run, it'll save us money and it'll keep our people healthier.
Brian Ewert.
First of all, health care is a right. Universal, affordable health care is a right for all Americans. In terms of the Affordable Care Act, it was a good step forward. It brought another almost 30 million Americans into health care, which was excellent. However, we need to continue to build on it. The next step that I envision would be the public option, which did not make it into the Affordable Care Act back in 2009. In doing this, we have people can opt into Medicare, and so if that's the right solution for individuals, businesses, or school districts, et cetera, they can opt into Medicare. It is the Choose Medicare Act. In this way, we do not force Americans into health care they don't want, but we do provide the choice so all Americans have the option of being covered through Medicare.
You know, the health insurance industry is a big employer here. Our medical institutions like the Marshfield Clinic, Aspirus, and Ascension are also big employers. They rely on private insurance companies. So, Margaret, how can you convince voters that a single-payer system wouldn't hurt workers who depend on the existing private insurance system for their livelihoods? And Brian, if you're going to allow this public option, isn't that going to essentially put these private insurers out of business if they're going to have to compete against Medicare? Margaret, why don't we start with you?
Well, with everything in policymaking, there are trade-offs. So if you look at the big picture here, we've got medical costs in this nation that are astronomically high, almost twice as much as the next nearest nation. So we need to phase out the health insurance industry because we're talking about people's health. And what we have set up right now is a profit-based system so that medical decisions and access to health care and drugs is decided by a private corporation based on the bottom line. We need to transfer that over to a public insurance system so that it's based on need. And taking away these administrative jobs, yes, will be hard on that industry, but we will need to absorb them into the Medicare system that will be expanded and to other industries.
Yes, thank you for bringing up the complexity of this, because since we're dealing with health care and people's lives literally depend on this, our first goal is to do no harm. So one of the reasons that I favor the Choose Medicare Act is that the fee schedules that they have in there are placed between the Medicare fee schedule, which often reimburses below cost, and the average of the Affordable Care Act fees. In that way, we do put pressure on to the healthcare system to continue to become more efficient, because we are paying twice as much and getting a product that isn't as good as Canada and Europe. More importantly, the Choose Medicare Act will negotiate fees with the pharmaceutical industry, which is where vulnerable Americans are being ripped off. And so we do need to transition, but we need to do it in a very careful and skillful way so that we do not hurt patients and we allow the healthcare industry to transition to the more efficient way of delivering care for patients.
Let's move to Danny Kading with the next question. Danny?
Yes, Margaret Engebretson, you say you want to build an economy that works for all of us. And Brian Ewert, you argue that the rural economy has not recovered since the Great Recession and that we have been left behind. How do you propose to grow the economy in the region? And please provide some specific examples.
And we're going to start with where are we at? We're going to start with Margaret with Brian Ewert on this one. Brian?
Well, in terms of growing the economy and making sure that workers actually catch up, there's three areas. It's education, so we want to make sure that everyone can achieve the education they need, and that comes through debt-free technical school and community college, as well as addressing the student loan crisis for further education. It comes from supporting our workers to make sure that workers are always on equal footing with management. And then it comes from gradually raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour while protecting small businesses. In terms of specific areas, we need to address climate change. In addressing that, we grow the renewable energy sector, which means we can now manufacture solar panels and windmills here in northern Wisconsin. Currently, Wisconsin is paying $15 billion outside the state to purchase fossil fuels. It would be much better to be investing that $15 billion here within the state in renewable energy. We help address climate change and all of the problems coming about from that. At the same time, we grow good jobs. Also addressing infrastructure with roads and bridges, we grow good jobs by repairing and rebuilding our infrastructure.
Margaret Engebretson?
Yes, I agree that the 7th Congressional and a lot of rural areas across our country have been devastated since the financial crash of 2008. And we were the hardest hit in a lot of ways and the slowest to recover. So one of the things we really need is a representative that will go to Washington and fight every single day to bring home the resources and the investments in our infrastructure, such as broadband, roads, rail lines. And we are missing out on a huge opportunity here. Up in Superior, we've got access to a great lake. We've got rail lines going into there. We have roads where we can truck out business. In the more rural areas, some places, some businesses are just dying on the vine out there because of lack of investment and lack of ability to access state markets, national markets, and global markets via using the internet with a broadband that is fast enough. Or you can drive an hour in this district and not have a cell phone signal. So, you know, some of these investments will build jobs by building this infrastructure, but it'll also provide a good place for small businesses to grow. And another way we need to help people is to have a Medicare for All public health insurance program so that these small business owners can compete.
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with more questions on the economy. You're listening to the Wisconsin Public Radio debate between Margaret Engebretson and Brian Ewert, the two Democrats who will be on the ballot in northern Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. Whoever wins the August 14th primary takes on incumbent Republican Sean Duffy in November. I'm Glenn Moberg in Wausau with my colleague Danny Kading in Superior. We'll be back with more after this. You're listening to the Wisconsin Public Radio debate between Margaret Engebretson and Brian Ewert, the two Democrats who will be on the ballot in the August 14th primary in northern Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. The winner takes on incumbent Republican Sean Duffy in November. If you'd like to participate, call in with your question or comment at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or post it on our website, wpr.org/route51. I'm Glenn Moberg in Wausau. And For our next question, let's look at another economic matter. What's your position on the Republican tax reform package, which passed on a party-line vote and was signed into law by President Trump? Republicans claim the law is partly responsible for the booming stock market and an economy which saw more than 4% increase in GDP last quarter. Are the Republicans correct? And why should people vote for Democrats in the midterm elections if the economy is doing so well? Let's start with Brian Ewert.
Yeah, unfortunately, in trying to work towards fair tax policy, the bill that was passed in December was unfair. First of all, at a time when we should be looking at shrinking our federal deficit, they grew the deficit by $1.5 trillion and in the process weakened Medicare. The Medicare Trust Fund now runs out of money 3 years early because of that way that tax law was passed. Also, they hurt elders because they changed the way cost of living is adjusted, and it's actually going to hurt our elders who are on Social Security. Also, what we know is that the tax benefits are permanent for the wealthy and they are temporary for the middle class. So clearly, fair tax policy is always an agenda item. However, this particular law was particularly harmful in the way it hurt elders, in the way it shortchanged the middle class. Even the corporate tax benefit went mostly to enriching CEOs through stock buybacks as opposed to having the benefit go to the workers.
And Margaret Agerbrunson?
Yeah, that tax law they passed without any Democratic support, without hearings, without, you know, bringing in all the people that are going to be affected by this major legislation was wrong and unethical in my view. We need to repeal and replace that tax law. It funneled almost all the benefits upward. We already have a huge wealth and income inequality situation in this country that is causing resentment and people to struggle. So we need to – I understand the corporate tax rate was kind of high, but the effective tax rate that our corporations are paying is really quite low. We need to sew up the loopholes and raise taxes on the ultra-wealthy in this country. Look, we all benefit from a standing military, from – you know, airports and roads and bridges and the education system that educates our children who grow up to be employees. So we're all in this together. And people need to start thinking about this as paying their fair share. If we invest in ourselves and invest in our people, we can do much better and we can thrive.
I want to follow up on something Brian brought up, and that's Social Security and Medicare. With the economy now facing $1 trillion deficits, how would you ensure the solvency of those programs, and do you think that they may be on the chopping blocks? And Margaret, why don't we start with your response?
This is something we've heard for, I don't know how many years now, decades. It's scaremongering. And there is a lot of talk about the deficit, the debt. And, oh, my goodness, Medicare is projected to be exhausted by, I think the latest thing is 2026. We need to address that issue, and we can do it in a few ways. One of the things that made it worse, unfortunately, was that tax law we were just talking about by repealing elements of the ACA that contain the costs of Medicare. So in the short run, we need to reinstitute those cost-saving measures. And ultimately, the solution is to transition to a Medicare for All public health insurance program that will bring down costs across the entire healthcare system. And we can also change how we are taxing and what goes into the trust fund. There are so we tax payroll, but we can also look at taxing unearned income such as capital gains and other items that way that will help shore up and strengthen the Medicare system, which is a great system, and we need to not allow people to scare us into cutting benefits.
Brian Ewert, how do we save Medicare and Social Security?
Well, first of all, the importance of doing so, because before Medicare and Social Security, becoming elderly meant becoming impoverished. Without these types of programs, the poverty rate amongst our elders would be 40% higher. So we do need to make sure that these are funded. Social Security is good until the 2030s right now. Medicare A and now is scheduled to run out of money in 2023. So first of all, recognizing that currently the way we fund those is by taxing labor. We do not tax investments because it comes through the payroll taxes, which means the person working for $8 an hour pays into Medicare and Social Security on the first dollar earned. So we need to have a fair structure regarding Social Security. After income exceeds 130,000, people no longer pay in. So there are ways that we can make sure that we honor our obligation to our elders so that they have a secure retirement, both for health care as well as their living expenses.
And let's move to our next question to Danny Kading. Danny?
Yes, I just wanted to ask you about education. Are educational needs being met in Wisconsin and across the nation? Why or why not? Margaret, you can start.
Well, every Wisconsinite knows and remembers what happened when Governor Walker was elected and Republican majorities in our legislature. And our unions were attacked, teachers. What they do for our children and provide to our communities was attacked. And over the years, what has happened is that we are losing talent across the border to Minnesota. I've personally talked to someone who recruits teachers over there who said, while it's very bad for you, it's excellent for us. And what we need to do is treat education like the important thing that it is. This is the first thing we must be investing in is our children and our future. And these are places where research is done, ideas are born, people grow and learn. And Wisconsin used to have the best university system in the nation, in my opinion. That's why I went to UW-Superior and UW Law School. And we are really shortchanging our future. So we must support teachers, we must support unions, and we must support investment into our education system.
Brian?
Yeah, I think this is one of those issues where identifying one's core values determines the policies that come forward. Unfortunately, under the current Walker administration, we have a devaluing of education and educators. Being a teacher should be one of the most optimistic professions there is, where you take young children and see the future 20 and 30 years later of what can come of this. Unfortunately, there's been this devaluing of education and educators. We need to restore that. My grandmother was a teacher in a one-room schoolhouse. I recognize how important this is. But clearly, at the federal level, we need to make sure that Head Start remains completely funded. We need to make sure that the funding for K through 12 for disabled students and economically disadvantaged school districts remains strong. And then we need to make sure that young adults can enter into a financially stable adulthood through debt-free trade school and community college, and then make sure that we have the appropriate funding for higher education so that they do not enter adulthood economically disadvantaged.
And Danny Kading, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, there's been discussion right now about reforming federal programs or streamlining them through the PROSPER Act. Do you think that federal programs should be reformed, Brian?
You know, I think the key issue is that the federal government has played a key role in higher education since the GI Bill. And one of President Roosevelt's last great ideas as his life was coming to completion. We need to continue to honor that we build a strong America by educating Americans. And so whether it be the GI Bill or the funding that was available in the 70s and 80s that made education affordable, we need to continue to strengthen those. And we need to address that we have a $1.5 trillion student loan debt crisis. I've had a 16-year-old look at me and say, if she goes to the UW systems, she will die in debt. Clearly, that should not be her future, that she should have a bright future where she emerges into adulthood financially stable.
Margaret Engerbretson?
Well, I have to let you know I have not read the PROSPER Act, so I wouldn't be an expert on that. However, education does need reform in this nation. I think that somewhere along the line we have decided to, whenever we tighten our belts, is to take it out of education and schools and our children. Quite frankly, we're failing our children in this country, and the student loan crisis is like an anvil tied around students' necks. I have one. Almost everyone I know has one. And so we do need deep reform. I would have to look at that bill and read it closely to see if I agree with it, if we should reauthorize it, or what we should do. But I can tell you for certain, we are not doing what we need to do, and we are wasting the potential and the futures of Americans, and it is absolutely wrong. We need to focus more on that.
You're listening to a debate between the Democratic candidates who are on the ballot in the 7th Congressional District, Margaret Ingebretson and Brian Ewert. I'm Glenn Moberg in Wausau with my colleague Danny Kading in Superior. Let's move on to environmental issues. Ned in Lake Dubay. Ned, I believe you have a question on that subject, and please be succinct. You've got 30 seconds for your question.
Okay, we need to speed the transition from a fossil fuel-based economy to renewable energy. 84 members of the U.S. House have joined the Climate Solutions Caucus, exactly 42 from each party. Many economists agree that we need a carbon fee and dividend approach. This would gradually add a fee to fossil fuels at the site of production. After 10 years, fossil fuels would cost more than renewable energy. All the fees would be collected, would be returned to households by means of a dividend. And finally, this is a free market approach, and it would improve public health with less coal fly ash from power plants and less tropical diseases such as Zika and West Nile virus extending into Wisconsin.
All right. Ned, thank you so much. Brian Ewert, we'll start with you.
Yes, thank you for the question. Yes, Citizens Climate Lobby, my wife and I have been contributing members now for several years. Certainly, I'm ready to get in line, and as soon as they find a Republican to join me, I will cross through the door. I think it was telling that we began the hour with NPR News with two key points. The current administration is rolling back fuel efficiency standards, and there's 90 large wildfires burning up Alaska and the western part of the United States. These are linked in terms of the cause. This is why you are absolutely correct. We need to transition from fossil fuels to renewables. I think the Citizens Climate Lobby has an excellent proposal so that we use the marketplace, just like we use the marketplace to subsidize fossil fuels. It's fair to use the marketplace to grow renewable energy sector.
Margaret Ingebretson?
Yes, Brian is right about that. Just today we find out that President Trump is trying to reduce the fuel efficiency standards. That is exactly the wrong direction and attitude to take towards this. I understand that climate change is such a big subject. It is hard to understand, and it is frightening because we are already seeing the impact of climate change and the personal and financial harm it's causing. We need to take aggressive steps to combat it by reducing carbon emissions. So as a first step, of course, we need to re-enter the Paris Climate Accord, and we need to reduce carbon emissions with a three-pronged strategy. We need to have regulation, put mandatory requirements in place to reduce carbon emissions. We need to raise the cost of fossil fuels. And like you said, Ned, the carbon fee and dividend proposal from the Citizens Climate Lobby is an excellent idea. And then finally, we need to subsidize the development of a clean energy economy.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio and our debate between Margaret Ingebretson and Brian Ewert, the two Democrats running for Congress in northern Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. Whoever wins the August 14th primary takes on incumbent Republican Sean Duffy in November. I'm Glenn Moberg in Wausau with my colleague Danny Kading in Superior. We will be back with more after this. And you are listening to the Wisconsin Public Radio debate between Margaret Ingebretson and Brian Ewert, the two Democrats who will be on the ballot in the August 14th primary in northern Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. The winner takes on incumbent Republican Sean Duffy in November. If you'd like to Submit a question for our candidates, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Moberg in Wausau. For our next question, we turn again to Danny Kading in Superior. Danny?
Thanks, Glenn. I just wanted to ask about immigration. What's your view on the president's policy there and actions taken to separate families? Margaret?
That is a disgrace, what's happening at the direction of President Trump and being carried out by our Border Patrol and ICE. It's just heartbreaking to have our nation, which I love and I know everyone else loves so deeply, to watch this, what we're doing. It's unconscionable. And the immigration situation in this country is something we've been grappling with for years. There are essentially only four things we can do for the roughly 11 million undocumented immigrants. We can do nothing, and we've seen the weaknesses of that approach and in the hands of someone who doesn't have strong feelings about treating other humans decently. We can try mass deportation, which isn't feasible. It would crash our economy. And we can create a legal status short of citizenship with no method to achieve citizenship. And that's not doable because we've had it in this country before, where we've had identifiable groups of people like African Americans and Native Americans who have had a second class status. And then the final thing, and this is where I stand on this, is we must provide a pathway to citizenship for those who are abide the laws, they're paying taxes, they're in our communities. This is the realistic thing we must do. Whether or not you're happy about them being here or not, this is the reality of the situation.
Brian Ewart?
Yeah, immigration is a great example of the failure of Congress in 2013. The Senate passed a bill and the House refused to even consider it. So I think this again speaks to why we need a change in Congress. Clearly, in terms of the families, separation that violates our core values and should never, ever happen again. In terms of the Dreamers, the young people who came here as children who are now law-abiding, hardworking residents here in America, we need a pathway to citizenship, them having come here as children. For the 11 million, they are a key part of our economy. If you pulled them out of the Wisconsin economy, it would be an $8 billion a year hit to our economy, and the dairy industry would probably collapse because that's who's milking our cows. So we need to work towards legal status for them. The reason for legal status is because it strengthens our communities. So they are willing to call the police when there's a domestic disturbance in the neighborhood. At the same time, by having legal status, it strengthens American workers because no longer can employers abuse illegal labor in to the detriment of American workers. While we bring them to legal status, we need to also honor those who have come to the United States through the clearly legal pathways. People who have gone through all the legal steps for citizenship. So I would say that if people started the process legally, they go all the way to citizenship. But for people who did not come in through legal channels, we bring them into legal status so that they are legal residents in the country. However, we stop short of citizenship.
Congressman Duffy is a strong supporter of Second Amendment rights. Hunting and gun ownership is a big deal in the 7th District. In fact, the very progressive Congressman Dave Obie, who represented the district for 41 years, was consistently given an A rating by the National Rifle Association. Should either of you be elected, do you think you'll get an A rating from the National Rifle Association? Brian Ewart.
Yeah, in terms of guns, I'm a gun owner and a hunter, and we certainly need to honor the Second Amendment rights of the millions and millions and vast majority of gun owners who very responsibly exercise their Second Amendment right. At the same time, we need to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people. That means strengthening background checks so that the people who committed the crimes in the churches and the murders in South Carolina and Texas would not have had their guns if we had background checks. At the same time, we need red flag laws so that people like the Parkland murderer could be identified. Everyone knew he was disturbed. He had behaved in a way that he lost his right. That needs to come through a judicial process, just like a warrant does for search. And finally, we need federal research. We need to fully repeal the Dickey Amendment from the 1990s so we treat gun deaths like we treat other public health deaths. Two-thirds are suicides, and here in northern Wisconsin, almost all gun deaths are suicide deaths. We need to understand what's causing them. We need to understand how we prevent them so that no family is faced with the tragedy of a loved one ending their life with the gun that the family has owned.
Margaret Ingebrigtsen?
Yeah, it's really unfortunate that this issue has become so divisive and so hot. The NRA is not going to give me a good rating. I can guarantee you that, because their involvement with our Congress, their lobbying, their advertising has really helped the issue become hard to deal with, hard to grapple with, and we must. I served in the military for 24 years. I was trained on an M16, various sidearms, anti-tank weapons. I know how to use explosives. I own a gun myself, and I view all of these things as tools, and they're for a specific task. People hunt in Wisconsin? You bet. That's fine. Home protection? Of course. But what we've got going on here is something out of control, and Congress is the one that needs to take charge of it. We must have universal background checks for every single person. We can limit magazine capacity sizes. I'm against selling military-style weapons to civilians. And we have a mass shooting epidemic in this nation that regulation will help, but we also need a holistic approach, mental health care, and other things to bring this down.
Let's go to my colleague Danny Kading in Superior, who has the next question. Danny?
Thanks again, Glenn. How important is national security as a priority, Margaret?
Yeah, that one, my whole life, that one has pretty much been the top of my list. I see that as the umbrella under which everything else fits. It's guided how I vote. It's guided that I enlisted in the military, and it's guiding me now and why I step forward to run for Congress at this time. I see national security as something that every American must pay attention to as citizens, and that this should be a nonpartisan affair in Washington. Unfortunately, it has turned into a very divisive topic. The military and veterans have been used as political pawns, and this is exactly the wrong way. We need to look at this whole thing. So we need to invest in our military, of course, but we also need to invest in diplomacy and development and foster good relationships with other nations and our economies, allow everyone to grow and thrive under it, because that's what makes a nation safe.
Brian Ewart?
Yes, certainly the goal of national security is to decrease threats to our country, and there are the three ways we do this. We do this through defense and the military, we do it through diplomacy, and we do it through development. General Mattis, currently the Secretary of Defense, stated before Congress that either the State Department can be funded up or you have to fund up more in the Department of Defense. Clearly, we always need to work towards non-military resolution of conflict whenever possible, because it is best for our economy, it's best for the civilians in the area, and extremely importantly, it's best for our military personnel, for them not to need to be put in harm's way. So I think it is crucial that we continue to work towards that, also recognizing that the United States spends one-third of the global military budget here in the United States. That is a burden on U.S. taxpayers. So we have our public resource. Right now, we are spending one-third of the global amount on that. So we always need to be mindful to how do we solve problems while making sure that we manage our public budget.
Danny Kading, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, I'm just curious if you think President Trump was right or wrong to have met with Russian President Vladimir Putin and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Brian?
I think for these types of meetings, what needs to happen before the president meets with them is to make sure that the background work is done. And I think we've seen with the varying results, even with North Korea, it is excellent that we have remains returned, that we're probably U.S. service people. However, we also know that missile sites are still being developed. In terms of President Putin, again, you need the background diplomacy, and certainly you need the people in the room so we know what's negotiated. You reserve these types of meetings between the leaders for when there really is a breakthrough. And that was the tradition that we had in the latter part of the 20th century when we had significant movement on treaties which brought more national security through excellent diplomacy.
Margaret?
Yeah, this president, President Trump, is not like other presidents. I think regardless of where you are in the political spectrum, we can all agree with that. And unfortunately, what has happened is we have a president that makes up his foreign policy as he goes along, rather than making use of the decades of experience in our State Department. And unfortunately, we've lost a lot of talent and experience out of the State Department. As far as meeting with Vladimir Putin, that's the elephant in the room ever since the 2016 election. Our intelligence agencies confirmed that at the direction of Putin, they have interfered in our democratic process. There are investigations going on, arrests that have happened, indictments that President Trump and or his campaign has some sort of relationship with President Putin. Now, as far as Kim Jong-un, yeah, the prospect of a nuclear annihilation is quite frightening. Unfortunately, I believe what happened there is this ended up being a feel-good photo op, and it's turned out that North Korea is at it again, building nuclear weapons.
And Jim from Weston on our website asks, is there a candidate who would promote policies which will promote peace in the Middle East? And I'm sorry to cut you this short. We're running really short on time, but if you could just give me your response in a few seconds. We'll start with you, Brian.
Yeah, clearly moving away from fossil fuels is a key way to promote peace in the Middle East, because that's been the reason we've had these conflicts in the 20th century, is because we've been fighting over oil. So, yes, we do need to promote peace in the Middle East. Part of that is transitioning the world to a lower fossil fuel economy.
Margaret?
Yeah, it's kind of funny that this one happened with the shortest amount of time, because it's the most complex thing on the planet, and we've been dealing with this forever. Look, it does have to do with oil, money, religious, sex, and power, control, borders. This is a deep issue, and we need diplomacy, lots of it.
Danny Kading, I think we've got time for one more question from you, and I think it's on the subject of marijuana.
Ah, yes. Do you support recreational marijuana or legalizing marijuana for medicinal purposes? Margaret?
Yeah, this one, like I mentioned earlier in an earlier answer, every policy choice has trade-offs. And this is one of those that, while there are some negative aspects to this, I believe that we should legalize marijuana both recreationally and medicinally.
Brian?
Yes, we should legalize it because it is a waste of taxpayer dollars to be incarcerating people. But however, we need to treat this like the other chemicals that we have legal, whether that be nicotine or alcohol. It needs to be used responsibly, and we need to educate our young people on how to be a responsible person who chooses whether or not to use marijuana.
So let me get this straight. You are both in favor of legalizing the recreational use of marijuana?
That is correct.
That's right.
One more quick question. Congressman Duffy has already raised more than $2.8 million for his reelection campaign. You each have a small fraction of that, less than 10% of that amount. How will either of you win a general election when you're going to be so outspent by Mr. Duffy? We'll start with you, Brian.
I think part of it is looking at the track record. Patty Shockner was outspent 3-1 in the 10th state district, and she won in a district that was heavily favored Republican. Connor Lamb won in Pennsylvania, being outspent 7-1. So we know it's that money and resources are important, but that's not all that matters. I think part of this is we've been in the pre-primary season, and donors do sit on the sidelines, so we're looking forward to August 15th to being after the primary. But clearly we're counting on the relationships we've been building for the last year to fuel the campaign and to outweigh the money that's available.
Margaret?
We'll never outraise Sean Duffy. He has millions, like you said. And the way I've approached this primary election and how I'll approach the general is what I've been doing and what people of the 7th want is I have driven thousands of miles. I have loved it. I have met hundreds of people and talked to them. And what we need to do in the 7th Congressional is rebuild from the bottom up a grassroots movement that isn't necessarily partisan, but it is citizen engaged and taking our country back.
Thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to the Wisconsin Public Radio Route 51 Hear Me Out debate between the two Democrats who will be on the ballot in the 7th Congressional District. Margaret Angerbrutson and Brian Ewert, they square off August 14th in the primary election. The winner takes on four-term Republican incumbent Congressman Sean Duffy in November. I'm Glenn Mobrig, the host of Route 51, our regional talk radio show based in Wausau, with Danny Kading, the host of Hear Me Out, our regional talk show based in Superior. Thanks to our executive producers Rick Ryer and Paul Damberg. Thanks to our on-air producer Janice Schleiss. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. If you missed part of this debate, you can hear it online at wpr.org/route51. Don't forget to vote on Tuesday, August 14th. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and thanks for listening.